we conceived. Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know?
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the divine Dar Williams singing to us with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song, back for another hour here of high-powered, green-powered Solartopian talk. We are joined by the great Arnie Gundersen, nuclear engineer based in Vermont, Michael Keegan, nuclear activist based, amazingly enough, in Monroe, Michigan, just a scant 100 or so yards from the statue of George Armstrong Custer, and not far from the Fermi 2 nuclear plant. We may be joined also by Milo Reason and Ace Hoffman. Are you guys there by chance? Okay, they will be calling us from Southern California. Arnie Gundersen, you are a premier leader now and go-to guy and all-around great person here in terms of dealing with nuclear power in its current decrepit, decaying, and increasingly dangerous demise. I want to talk specifically today with you to start, at any rate, with San Onofre, the nuclear plants in Southern California, which are shut, thankfully. We may also be joined by Kendra from Friends of the Earth. Kendra, are you with us yet? Okay. Hello? Oh, Kendra, you are here.
I am here.
Oh, very good. Okay, so I've introduced Kendra. You are with Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth is also taking a major role here in dealing with the San Onofre nuclear plant, including a miraculously victorious challenge at the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board on the relicensing question, or the well, it's really a complicated question. Is it really a relicensing question? Well, let me start with Arnie Gundersen, who I introduced in the beginning here. Arnie, I've read here, I'm looking at online, an article in SNL entitled by Christine Cordner, entitled "NRC Gets Vague on Timeframes for San Onofre Nuke Restart Decisions." What can you tell us about the timing? And Kendra, you can chime in, please, on what we're expecting now, what kind of timeframe we're expecting on any possible attempt to reopen the San Onofre nuclear reactor. Unit 2, anyway.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the beginning of 2012 when the plant broke. A tube failed, radioactivity entered the secondary side of the plant, was released out the out of vent into the environment. And at that point, and only at that point, they knew they had something wrong. So they shut down, and very rapidly they were saying to the public, we'll have it up next summer. We'll have it up in the summer of 2012. Friends of the Earth asked me to take a look at it and see what I could find. And I got to give a lot of credit here to Friends of the Earth, because had they not been interested, I don't think the NRC would have given this thing the right oversight. But anyway, summer came, and they realized that there's lots of problems with this steam generator, and it was delayed again and again and again. We're out now in the second summer. You know, this plant's been shut down now for 15 months and likely heading toward 18 months. And the question is, it got through the summer, last summer, and why all the gloom and doom? It looks to me like California can survive quite well without this dangerous plant starting back up. Well, it looks like the SNL story today said that the NRC had been claiming that it was going to have a recommendation by the end of June on their website, and on Friday that was deleted, and they just put "to be determined," which tells me that the NRC still has grave concerns, and Southern California may go a second summer without that reactor running. Well, if it goes two summers in a row without running, it's hard to imagine why it's needed at all. And I think that's Edison's concern. They want to get this plant in the rate base again so they can claim that Southern California can't do without it.
Kendra, can you join in on that? You were friends of the Earth. I was in your office on Friday in mm-hmm. D.C., has been a major force in pushing forward this challenge to the restart at San Onofre. And can you tell us a bit more about what's been going on?
Sure. So Arnie had alluded to this, and I just have to say he gave us a lot of credit, but our challenges were based in large part on a lot of the great work that Arnie did for us. So lots of credit to Arnie. But in any event, we had filed a petition with the NRC back in June of 2012, arguing that the major design changes they made to this defective replacement equipment that failed so quickly, less than a year and less than 2 years respectively after being installed, wasn't like for like, and they should have had to go through the license amendment process initially for their design changes. We also were arguing that they needed to have a license amendment process before either reactor was allowed to restart. In October, Edison filed for their restart.
This is October 2012.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep. Following the shutdown and the petition that we filed in June of 2012. In any event, in October 3rd of 2012, they submitted a response to a confirmatory action letter that the NRC had issued to them, as well as an experimental restart proposal for the Unit 2 reactor. Now, it's twin reactor.
Wait. You use the word experimental. Who is that FOE's word? I happen to know the answer to this, but where did the word experimental come from?
Well, we've been saying it's experimental ever since we took a look at it. And that was actually affirmed by the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board decision, which I'll get to in just a minute. But what Edison was essentially proposing was restarting a reactor that has incredibly damaged equipment without fully understanding what the cause of the damage is. Their own experts disagree as to the cause of the pervasive tube damage that we're seeing. And without fixing it for 5 months and essentially seeing what happens. So they have a hypothesis about what they think is causing the problem and what they think might be a safe way to run it, without having any evidence to back it up, because we're talking about a globally unique problem. So there's
Globally
data.
Unique? Are you saying that the problems of the at San Onofre are not evident in other nuclear plants around the world?
That's correct. So the problem with the in-plane, what's called in-plane FEI, in-plane fluid elastic instability,
really opaque, dweeby term. Can you say that term again, will you please?
In-plane fluid elastic instability.
In-plane
fluid elastic instability. That's correct.
Which means basically the pipes are banging against each other.
Yeah, but they're doing it essentially forward and backward, and Arnie can elaborate a little bit more on this and explain it. But rather than out of plane, which is kind of side to side, this is going forward and backward. So it's hitting the tubes above it and below it within the tube bundle. So the tubes within San Onofre are called U-tubes, so they're bent at the top.
U-tubes.
Uh-huh. So at the bend at the top, so you can think of, you know, a piece of grass that you take each end and just bend it. So at the very top there where the bend is where we're having this massive tube degradation problem. But we're also having problems kind of in the straight portion of the tubes as well with tube support, so the tube support plates, things that are intended to hold the tubes in place. They were actually seeing damage there as well. But one of the main things that they've been really focused on is the tubes hitting one another, the tube-to-tube wear. And that is caused by this fluid elastic instability in the in-plane direction, which is globally unique.
Is globally unique in a sense? Maybe we don't know why exactly, but because there's no other steam generator that's been set up like this. Now, let me set the stage here, and please correct me, Arnie or Kendra or Mike Keegan. You're with us too. You're going to fill us in on Michigan at some point, but The steam generators, the tubes, at San Onofre units 2 and 3, which are old reactors. Maybe you can tell me what years they opened. Certainly in the 70s or 80s. But they were due for a trade out, and so Southern California Edison, the primary owner of the San Onofre, although it's also owned by San Diego Gas and Electric and the town of Riverside, I believe, mm-hmm. among others. So they decided to get fancy, and with Mitsubishi, they put in what we'll euphemistically call an upgraded steam generator tubing array. Is that correct, Arnie? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So stick with me here because I want to set the picture. Maybe some of our listeners are, and we do have listeners, by the way. I have the numbers are in from PRN, and they're actually pretty good. We have many hundreds of people listening at from time to time, or even as we're talking now. So we're going to proceed to set this. So Southern California Edison with the Mitsubishi. Somebody at either one of these companies, maybe we'll find out, had the bright idea to make some changes, which apparently is not allowed under the license. Is that correct? I mean, it appears to Senator Barbara Boxer and Representative Ed Markey, who wrote Edison asking about this, that they may have violated the terms of their license by doing a so-called upgrade on these tubes. Is that possible?
Yeah, the NRC allows you to replace in kind without mm-hmm. getting a new license, and they call that fit form function or like for like, and they allow you to replace. But what Edison did was to come up with essentially a brand new design, and they claimed that it fit within the envelope of the original steam generator, which is just patently absurd.
Well, now this is a big deal here. We're talking about, you know, $770 million mm-hmm. that Edison spent to put in this new steam generator, and you're telling me basically, I mean, it's kind of astounding when you think of it. You're telling me basically they cheated on their license?
Well, they gamed the process, and the NRC let them get away with it for years. But it's actually worse than that, Harvey. It starts back in 2004. Edison didn't want the public involved. So Edison told Mitsubishi, here's your answer. You're going to say that this thing fits the original steam generator envelope. And by contract, Mitsubishi agreed to that. So Edison told Mitsubishi the answer before Mitsubishi ever built these generators.
Well, that's staggering.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. As Mitsubishi's developing them, they find problems. And one of the reasons they didn't go to the NRC with the problems was that they were contractually prohibited because of the contract with Southern California Edison.
So essentially what we have here, and this, of course, was raised, this possibility was raised in a letter from Senator Boxer and Representative Markey, asking for clarification. And what you're saying, essentially, Arnie Gunderson, is that Edison knew that they were messing with the process, and they ordered their supplier to not tell the truth. Is that a fair assessment here?
Mitsubishi signed the contract. You know, they're big boys, too. So both of them agreed not to tell the NRC if the analysis showed that modifications were needed and that a public license were required. You know, Edison wanted the public's money. They wanted that $800 million to build it. But they wanted also to keep the public out of the licensing process.
Oh, and they wanted what they thought was a steam generator system that would give them more power. Correct. I mean, they went with a new design because they thought they could realize more power from the reactor. I mean, what other reason would there be?
Well, they went with a new design for zillions of reasons, but one of the keys is they had thought that this generator would run for 60 more years.
That's 60.
60 more
this
years.
This is
in
a new
fact,
design.
It ran 11 months. But in the back of their mind, they said, well, if we add pipes here and we make this change here, We'll make it so good it'll run for 60 more years.
Who said that? Did Mitsubishi tell them that?
No, that was Edison had actually said that they thought they could get another 20-year license on top of the original 20-year license. They actually thought that they could get out into the middle of the century with this steam generator.
Whose idea was this? I mean, did someone in the Edison engineering department come up with the idea or the design concept for this fancy new steam generator system?
Well, the old steam generator was gradually deteriorating, you know, like all these old plants
across
the nation. So they had to replace the steam generator eventually.
Was that the original steam generator?
Yes, the original one ran 30 years.
So it had opened, what, in the 70s? When did the Santa Rosa units 2 and 3 open?
They're 30 years old, so they're back off 30 years from today, and they're end of the 70s.
And so somebody at Edison thought that with a new steam generator design, but then they would have had to turn around and tell the NRC about this, right? I mean, if they're going to go for a license extension, at some point they would have to turn around to the NRC, and I guess they didn't think of this, and say, hey, we put in new steam generators, therefore give us a longer life extension. And the NRC, somebody would say, well, but you didn't apply for a license for new steam generators. Did that not occur to anybody?
I think they were going to do it incrementally. You know, they were going to get the steam generator built and installed on public money, and then they were going to go to the NRC and say, hey, we've got this nice, shiny steam generator. Give us a license extension.
Kendra,
so
is that
an incremental approach?
Yeah, I just want to clarify that a little bit. So they did tell the NRC about these design changes, but they presented them as the same, as Arnie pointed out, as like for like, as in these would not have a major impact on the way that the steam generators would function.
Well, that's a different
and
question.
And the NRC was completely asleep at the regulatory wheel as well and failed to really recognize how significant these design changes actually were.
So the NRC was told that these design changes were being made.
Mm-hmm.
But they bought Edison's line that it was still the same.
Yeah. That's exactly it.
Okay. And do we know what drugs the NRC is taking?
I don't know, but I think our society might fall apart if we were all taking them. one of the things that I did want to point out, though, is going back to the ruling that we just had last week, is that the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which is a three-panel judicial panel of administrative judges, came back and not only did they say that Edison should have to go through this license amendment, that allowing them to restart was effectively allowing them to operate outside of the scope of their current license, but they were also very, very clear not only that the restart plan was an experiment, and they said it was an experiment in their opinion, but also that these were not like-for-like replacements. So that has huge ramifications for going back. We also have a petition before the Petitions Review Board, which Arnie is our nuclear expert on that, going back and taking a look retroactively at what the NRC did in terms of their own regulations and failing to enforce them. And the fact that the ASLB, which took a look at the design of these things, has also affirmed everything that Arnie has said, everything that FOE has been saying, that these were not like-for-like replacements, and that these were major design changes that had major impacts on the function, is absolutely huge.
Wow. So the ASLB basically has said what you just said, which is that the NRC was somehow on drugs or asleep at the wheel, right?
Well, what they said was, yeah, these were not like-for-like replacements. Now, obviously, Edison misrepresented them, but the, you know, NRC themselves, the staff who reviewed those design changes, failed to recognize how significant they actually were and require Edison to go through that license amendment.
Now, the reason that it's so significant on a license amendment, among other things, is that it does require an adjudicated public hearing. Is that correct?
That's right.
So
that's
if the ASLB ruling were to stand, then the Edison would be forced to go in front of the public under oath at a hearing. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing about the ASLB hearing, because it will be before another, a separate Atomic Safety and Licensing Board panel of judges. And that in particular, I mean, that allows for independent expert testimony, cross-examination. Edison would have to put up, you know, their experts on this issue. And so there would be that thorough vetting of this experimental restart plan. And quite frankly, it doesn't mean just because they apply for a license amendment, or in this case, they have been essentially told that this is a license amendment process and therefore the public is entitled to a hearing, that they would actually get one, because this is a defective design. They are restarting under the assumption that, you know, this critical equipment that provides a critical radiation barrier would progressively destroy itself. And that's their own experts.
So, oh, wait a minute. You know, whose own experts?
Edison's own experts.
Edison's, and repeat what you just said. Edison's own experts have said what?
That the degradation will continue. So, you know, they're experimentally restarting under the assumption that, you know, the damage will continue, that these will be progressively destroying themselves. And this is critical, you know, reactor equipment. So, you know, just because they go through that process doesn't mean that they get a license amendment. And any independent, and that's why we're pushing so hard for this, any independent body that's reviewing this, I mean, would you give a license to such severely damaged equipment that's obviously of defective design that's being restarted under the premise that it will progressively destroy itself? And I think most rational people would say, no, absolutely not. But it requires that kind of independent review, because we are seeing from the regulator what we've seen over decades, which is them acquiescing to the industry. And certainly Edison has a very vested interest in getting these things restarted.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if they blow, then, but we won't talk about that at this point in the radio show. So, but now the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, I would say, is kind of like the, U.S. Court of Appeals. We still have a Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And this decision by the ASLB, and correct me if I'm wrong, Arnie or Kendra, or Mike, you can keep, from Michigan, you can kick in too if you like. The ASLB has voted unanimously, like 3-0, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And these are who are these three people? Are they engineers? Are they nuclear physicists? Are they friends of yours, Arnie? I mean, who are the three people in the ASLB who have decided that this needs a hearing?
Well, one of them is an engineer, and two are lawyers. That's the way all the boards are constituted. They also have, you know, staff help too. But the panel themselves is made up of one engineer and two lawyers.
And are these full-time employees of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Yes. There's a group, and they constitute an ASLB by drawing members from the group. So different members work on different ASLBs routinely.
And what do they do when they're not working on the ASLB?
They're working on another ASLB.
Oh, I see. How many ASLBs are there?
Every time a plant has a question that the public wants to become involved in, whether it's a license extension or a power uprate, an ASLB is formed. So they're constantly forming and being dissolved.
I see. And how big is the pool of people who serve on the ASLBs?
Oh, I can name about nine of them, but I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. So, and obviously, this is a very highly credible group of people. And they meet in public, do they not, or do they meet in secret? Were there any ASLB hearings prior to this that were public?
Yeah, there was an ASLB oral argument that happened on March 22nd, and that was public.
And so where was it conducted?
It was on March 22nd.
Where?
Oh, I'm sorry, Rockville, Maryland.
Okay, so was that NRC headquarters?
That's right.
Okay, and Michael Keegan, you're sitting there patiently. You're doing the same, a similar challenge, but we won't talk too deeply about it, about the Fermi 2 plant. Is that correct?
Yeah, it would be the Fermi 3. There's a proposal to build a Fermi 3 in Monroe, Michigan, right on the same nuclear complex that had a core melt in 1966 with the Fermi 1, and then they've got the Fermi 2 there, which is limping along on one feed water pump, and looks like they'll be running in that situation for about 2 years total.
Well, to me, you know, the idea of building Fermi 3 is like asking Custer to go back into the little Bighorn for a third try. Sorry. Go ahead.
It's all about greed. It's not about need. And they see lots of money. And so I'm into prevention here. And the whole nuclear renaissance is predicated on the assumption that they're going to get federal loans and guarantees, and they're going to get ratepayers to pay for it as it's being built. Nowhere along the line will these nuclear industries put their skin in the game, which creates a moral hazard. But at the Fermi 3, we're intervening, and we've contracted with Arne Gundersen, Fairwinds Associates. We're looking at the quality assurance program at the Fermi 3, and virtually invisible not competent, not traceable. So it's a back and forth volley we've got going there. Who's in charge? The quality assurance that began with the application process, which is sort of like a shotgun running, they went down to a September deadline in order to be eligible for tax benefits. And so that was the driving force, and so get the thing in, but they got it in, and the quality assurance is lacking. So, and we see that continuing to this day with the project. They're already 2 3/4 a year behind schedule. They're having soil structure analysis problems and foundation issues. So they're already nearly 3 years behind schedule, and they haven't even broke ground yet. So,
I like that. That's good. 3 years behind schedule, and they haven't started construction. Arne Gundersen and Kendra, were there quality assurance, quality control issues with the installation of the new steam tubes at San Onofre?
Yes, there were problems with the tubes that were manufactured over in Japan. The lubricant used on the tube was actually not qualified to be used in that tube, which meant that it was aggressive and ate away at the tube as opposed to protecting the tubes.
Say that again. You're saying that the thing that they put on the tubes to protect it, I mean, we're talking about jelly here, right? That whatever they put on the tubes to protect it wound up eating it away?
Yeah, the cutting oils that they were using weren't qualified for the tube that they were trying to cut. And in fact, they were aggressive at attacking the tube as opposed to protecting the tube.
And this what year are we talking about? How many years has Mitsubishi been making steam generator tubes that they would make a mistake like that?
Well, Mitsubishi sent them out to a subcontractor, and this happened back in 06. But the problems at San Onofre aren't quality assurance related. They go right back to the original design, and these guys tried to push the envelope, they tried to put too big a letter in an envelope, and the envelope cracked. You know, it's that simple.
But these substances that they put on the tubes, did they do damage? Are we seeing any evidence of problems resulting from that?
Well, they caught it and cleaned them and removed it. And there's no evidence that the problems that they're seeing now are due to that problem. They have enough problems without another one.
But that did occur that's very reassuring, of course, that it occurred in the construction process here.
Yeah, so, it occurred in fabrication.
Right. So, Michael Keegan, you in Michigan you're fighting a plant that's under construction in San Onofre. We have two reactors that are shut down that we're trying to prevent from a reopening. And that, I have to say, as someone who's been doing this, this is my 40th year fighting nuclear plants. Michael, I think you've been in it as long, Arne. Kendra, of course, you're way too young. This is astonishing to see that they continue to have no learning curve. I mean, Kendra, Friends of the Earth jumped into this. You've been in this for a long time, your organization. Isn't one of the reasons that there's so much focus on San Onofre that we actually have a shot at keeping reactors shut?
Yeah, I mean, we are very focused on San Onofre for a number of reasons. One, because California is really poised to be a leader in transitioning from this old energy regime of kind of fossil fuels and nukes to moving towards diversified renewables, energy storage, et cetera. So, you know, there in and of itself is a real opportunity to show where we can go and what can be done. And San Onofre in particular is of, you know, great interest to us because we're talking about two nuclear reactors with extremely defective equipment between two of the largest cities in Southern California.
Well, in the
relatively
world.
Close, yes, and relatively close to a major port for the entire country.
Well, we know there are 8 million people.
And tsunami zone.
Right, there are 8 million people within a 50-mile radius.
There's over 8 million, yeah.
And I don't know what the number is within a 100-mile radius, but I think it's well over.
Right.
You know, it's probably in the range of 15 to 20 million people.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge population in Los Angeles, which includes, by the way, my grandson, which is one of the reasons I'm so focused on this. The idea, well, Kendra, you mentioned that San Onofre is in an earthquake zone, and it's also a tidal wave zone. For those of you who want to see a picture of the plant, go to nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E.org, sort through the various postings there. San Onofre is unique, I think, in among other things, in that it's a stone's throw from the high tide line and from a major interstate. I mean, this thing is scrunched. I've driven by it many times. It's scrunched right in the middle of the ocean and the I-5. It's astounding that it would be put there. Now, one of the issues also, and just to step out of the federal realm for a moment, is that there are water quality issues at San Onofre, and this is a developing story at nuclear plants all over the country, the state water quality regulations. And we believe, the people I work with at Greenpeace and elsewhere believe that the state actually does have the right to demand cooling towers at San Onofre, which I think would be game over. Have you, Arnie or Kendra, worked on this at San Onofre?
The world's best expert on cooling towers lives in San Diego, and I would defer to him on San Onofre. But it clearly, you know, if they get over this hurdle, if they get this plant running at 70% and the other one never starts back up again, the next hurdle is now they've got to build cooling towers because they're destroying all the fish eggs in the ocean. If they pull the ocean water through to cool the plant, they essentially cook the fish eggs. And you just can't do that for 40 years and expect that it doesn't have an effect on the population.
Right, and I understand that they built an artificial reef there with hanging seaweed and all that stuff, and there have been no signs of large fish that have come back yet. So, but let's get back to the federal side now, because you two are Kendra and Arnie with Mike, who's had tremendous experience in this in Michigan. All eyes now are on what the NRC is saying about the timeline for this process. Whatever it would take to get San Onofre back up and running for Southern California Edison, clearly now it's going to require some kind of approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, the ASLB, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, has ruled that there must be a hearing. The commissioners, the five commissioners, do have the power, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, to override that. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, it's important to note, though, that they would be in a very awkward position to do that.
Why?
Because the commissioners themselves, and what I was talking about earlier about the petition we had filed in June, what they had done in November was a unanimous vote on that petition to defer it and to do different processes, which was the Petitions Review Board and this Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. So, in effect, they themselves appointed the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which is not the way this usually happens, to evaluate this question on the merits. So effectively, they would be overturning the judgment of their own self-appointed Atomic Safety and Licensing Board because they didn't like what they had to say once they had heard all of the facts. So that puts the commissioners in a very awkward position, not saying that they couldn't do it, but it makes it even more awkward because they're the ones that instituted this to evaluate this very question, which is whether or not this is, in fact, a de facto license amendment process.
Uh-huh. Arnie, what's your take on what the commissioners might or might not do with this ASLB ruling?
Well, there's two commissioners that are incredibly pro-nuclear, and you need a majority of five. So It really depends on the other three commissioners. I suspect Edison will appeal directly to the commissioners and hope that they can get one of those last three to agree with them. Mm-hmm. No, but the public perception has got to be a factor in this. If they were to do that, to go to the commission and ask for a redo, you know, what would the public think if it got reversed by the commission? Here's judges, you know, that studied this thing for months, and the NRC is gonna turn it around on a whim. You know, I agree with Kendra. It's politically very difficult for them to do. But again, two of the five commissioners are very pro-nuclear, and you just got to get one more and you win.
Right. Now, let me point out, you know, someone who's been following this and with family in Southern California, that there's a tremendous amount of public interest now in this. This is not going to go under the rug here. We've had a letter from the senator, I think she's the junior senator, but Senator Barbara Boxer of California, from Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who hopefully will soon be the senator from Massachusetts. And a very tremendous amount of media now, the LA papers and the San Diego papers are paying very close attention to this. I would have to say, even though I'm biased, obviously, that the tone of the papers is, of the general media comment has been very negative towards Edison. Very concerned, of course, in the wake of Fukushima, especially, about two reactors, that are in an earthquake zone, and vulnerable to tsunami. By the way, Myla Reeson, I don't know if she's on here or not, but has pointed out to me, as has Ace Hoffman, that the flood wall at San Onofre is all of 14 feet. And the tsunami at Fukushima was, in some cases, 10 times that height. So there's really no effective protection for that plant in case of a tsunami. But that's not what it is an issue here. If worst-case scenario, if the commissioners did overturn the ASLB, what would happen next?
It would be allowed to start up after, you know, 30 days of startup work, getting the plant ready to run. And, you know, of course, I feel, and other experts, a great analytical guy from England named John Large, and a former NRC steam generator expert, have all questioned whether these tubes will last for 5 months. You know, our fear is that another tube will burst, or a group of tubes will burst. And the plant is not designed to handle more than one tube bursting.
Wow. How many tubes are there?
Yeah, no, what happens is that the nuclear core can't make up for the lost water. And there's no procedure. The operators aren't trained on how to mitigate against cascading tube failures.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, if these tubes fail, and a second one fails, they sort of bump into each other like dominoes. And considering, you know, like Kendra said, these are degraded to begin with. So you get a domino failure of these tubes, and the core begins to melt down. It's that simple. You know, I was in Tokyo last year twice, but the first time I was there, and Tokyo is a long way away from the Fukushima reactors. It's 140 miles. Not like, you know, L.A., that's 50 miles. And I was taking sample bags along the sides of sidewalks and finding that the dirt would qualify as radioactive waste in the United States. And so I look at, you know, you were talking about how the media is concerned about this. Well, the public should be concerned. I mean, can you imagine going out into your garden and kneeling in radioactive waste?
Well, I'm sure it's happening all the time. And we do know the radiation did come from Fukushima to the West Coast, quite easily detectable, as it did from Chernobyl. But the point is now, worst case scenario, the commissioners overturn the ASLB. Isn't there still a comment period that they have to honor? Or are we done? I mean, can the commissioners just say, hey, forget about the ASLB, Southern California Edison, here's your license, go ahead and operate? Hello?
Hello? Yeah, the commission could do that. But again, you know, as we've said, I mean, they could overrule the ASLB.
Yeah, all right.
It's entirely within their power to do so, but as I pointed out and as Arnie pointed out, you know, it is politically challenging. It's not saying that they won't do it, but it is politically challenging given the amount of scrutiny, not just public scrutiny, but by members of Congress. And Senator Barbara Boxer is a senior member of Congress and is the chair of the NRC Oversight Committee, and she has been very, very engaged with this issue. But we've also seen a lot of local electeds getting very involved. The mayor of San Diego has made statements about San Onofre and the need for a license amendment. We just had the Assembly Majority Leader for the state of California submit formal comment to the NRC saying that this narrow license amendment that they have applied for, that Edison has applied for, is inappropriate and that they need to go through a thorough license amendment process. So, you know, there's a lot of political interest at play. And it's founded upon, you know, the technical expertise that we've been able to present.
Yes, I agree. Marla Reeson, are you with us? Marla? Or Ace Hoffman? I should have a couple callers from Southern California, but if they're not. Hello?
Hello?
Marla.
Yes.
This is Marla Reeson calling us from Southern California. Marla, you know, we've had new developments. We're still we're having some waffling now from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And what's your take on the status of public opinion there in Southern California in terms of the restart? What kind of price would the NRC pay if they just blew off the ASLB and started to flip the switch here?
Well, my hope is that public awareness is so high. My hope is that public awareness is so high now that that they won't get away with it, but you never know. I did call the public affairs people in Region 4, and I talked to someone at the commissioner's office, Chairwoman McFarland's office, and they're really kind of scrambling in terms of trying to figure out a way to analyze this and see whether it's even possible to reverse the decision. Of course, that's what Edison is pushing for. But I'm hoping that Kendra and Arnie are right, that the public opinion, I think that, you know, all of the elected officials who are looking closely at this now have tremendous influence on the process.
Well, you know, would you characterize the groundswell there as being pretty much against the restart?
Oh, absolutely, especially in San Diego and closer to the plant, you know. And awareness is building in Los Angeles as well.
Now, Los Angeles, the city council has passed a unanimous resolution asking for what?
More scrutiny, a full vetting of all of the issues involved.
Uh-huh. Ace Hoffman, are you with us? Okay, I guess Ace hasn't...
Yeah, I'm here, Harvey.
Oh, yeah, Ace. So you're doing a lot of public campaigning out there along with Myla on the ground. What's your feeling about the public sentiment here on the restart of San Onofre?
Well, of course, I've been fighting nuclear power for nearly 40 years like you have, and I've never seen anything like this in the last year and a half since the problem started after Fukushima. The awareness in this community in Southern California is at an all-time high, at least an all-time high in my lifetime.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Do you think it's going to be sufficient to throw the fear of God into either maybe Jerry Brown or the California Public Utilities Commission to do something about this?
I think people are making a difference. They had a hearing at the California Public Utilities Commission last week, and in the morning, the first thing they did was announce that there was going to be no photography and no record kept, no webcast. And by the afternoon, they announced that the webcast will begin on Tuesday, because there was such a public outcry right that day. And, you know, we can mobilize that kind of stuff now because we have so many people working on it, the Friends of the Earth and all the local people. It's quite amazing.
Well,
I don't know if it'll be successful, but we're trying.
Okay. Arnie Gunderson, your long experience pretty close to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, do you think this kind of public outcry does have an impact, or are they just going to blow it off?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. You know, when you've got a public outcry, you have a political base. And the NRC does not ignore newspapers and does not ignore senators writing them letters. You know, we've got plants, though, in places around the country, like Fort Calhoun in Nebraska. You know, that there is no public outcry. And the plant has fallen apart. But yet the NRC will allow it to operate in the future because there's no public outcry. So, yeah, public outcry is critical to the success of getting the NRC to pay attention.
Well, you mentioned Fort Calhoun. I want to talk about Fort Calhoun for a minute, because Fort Calhoun, there are some great aerial, let's not say great, there's some amazing aerial photographs of Fort Calhoun essentially underwater. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, Fort Calhoun was flooded.
This is in Nebraska. This is one of the two reactors in Nebraska.
Yeah, the Missouri flooded last year, and the plant took the right course and shut down ahead of the flood. But in the process, they discovered a whole bunch of other things that were wrong, including, obviously, the effects of the flood on the foundation and things like that. But beyond that, they went back and they started to look at their old records, and they couldn't find the old records. Sometimes they found pieces of the old records, and when they could look at the old records, they were wrong. And yet the NRC is not interested in broadening this and saying, my God, this plant is one of the oldest in the country. Why? How do these records get to be such a mess? And why should we allow them to start back up unless there's, some sort of a way to reconstitute the bases upon which the plant was built? Well, you can't do that. It's like when you have an airplane. You know, they always talk about the book on the airplane. Every single change on an airplane is noted in a book. Well, Fort Calhoun lost their book.
They lost it?
And they want to fly anyway. And I just don't think that's a very good way of running an airline, and I certainly don't think it's a good way to run a nuclear
airline. Wait. Arnie Gunderson, you have just said that the operators of a nuclear power plant lost their essential record book?
Well, we call it configuration management, and they lost control of the changes they had made to the power plant. Now, they don't have a book. They've got a room of, you know, the size of a small house, and the records are missing upon which the plant was built, yeah.
Would they wash away in the flood?
No, I'm afraid they may have never existed from back in the 70s.
Oh, my God. Michael Keegan at Fermi, has anything like that happened at any of the three reactors at Fermi?
Oh, certainly. It's quality assurance, and they lack it. They don't want to do the job right to begin with. At Fermi, Fermi 2, they could not move the high-level nuclear waste off the fifth floor down to ground level because the vertical beams would not support the weight. They wouldn't support the weight because they were missing 768 welds that were never put in place. When they compared the blueprints to how the plant was built, lo and behold, they had to go back and do remedial welds on 768 welds. So the quality assurance is terrible throughout the industry, and I think that's what's going on at Fort Calhoun. Today there was an event report on seismic related on Fort Calhoun. These things are just not built as they were intended. It's shoddy work. You know, the money's flown, and contracts are let, but no, who's keeping track? And as Arnie says, the documents room is the size of a house, and they're not tracking.
You know, I'd like to weigh in on Fort Calhoun. When that flooding happened, they had this enormous, something like a big rubber tire around the facility to prevent the really important parts of the facility from being flooded. And one of the operators of some of the moving equipment punctured the big rubber tire and allowed the floodwaters to come into the plant.
Yes, that's one of my favorite stories. That's right up there with the rat that ate through the cooling wires at Fukushima, and so they almost lost cooling to the spent fuel there, and so they went in to put another protective wiring around the cabling, and they screwed up the cabling a second time. And then another rodent came and ate another piece of the wire. Is that correct, Arnie? Is that a reasonable narration of what happened there?
Yeah, yeah. You know, let's get on Fort Calhoun, they did not face the worst flood. And NRC whistleblowers have come forward and said this, too. There are dams upstream that were filled to overflowing. And there's experts in the Nebraska area that will say that those dams were in jeopardy of failing. Well, if those dams had failed, Fort Calhoun would have turned into a submarine. And the NRC doesn't look at their own internal reports that identified this years ago, and in fact is investigating the whistleblowers who breached the report to the public.
God. Now, my buddy Jim Riccio at Greenpeace is working on the three reactors of Oconee in South Carolina, which some have argued are at the worst risk of any American reactors from a dam from flooding.
Yes, Oconee's the worst in the country.
So, it's mind-boggling.
I think at the bottom of all this, Harvey, is that we have an agency that really doesn't regulate. It enables these plants to continue to operate.
Yes. So let's go back to San Onofre now, since we started there and we want to finish there. If the ASLB ruling stands and the hearings do occur, what now are the prospects for this reopening, restart of San Onofre? Anybody? Ace, Myra, Kendra?
Who can tell?
Well, if the ASLB ruling stands, and they have to go through this thorough vetting process. Now, that's assuming that they don't try to do what they did with this other license amendment, which is say there's no significant hazard from restarting a reactor with critically damaged equipment. But assuming if the NRC did the right thing and upholds the ASLB ruling and goes through the proper vetting process, particularly for some of these vibration analysis that the judges pointed out weren't included, that's a very long process. So we're looking at, 6 months, maybe a year, process for the license amendment itself, whether or not that would be approved. Now, Ted Craver, who is the head of Edison International, of which Southern California is a subsidiary, has said that if they don't get approval to restart, by the end of the year, that they're pulling the plug. So, they're indicating, and when I first read that, it was, more to me that this was Edison's attempt to put more pressure on the NRC. However, to give them approval to restart. However, it is indicative of kind of how they're thinking about this. Like, we have to rush the restart or we're done. And that in and of itself, raises concerns about their motivations for, rushing this restart. But if they don't get this restart approval and the ASLB ruling stands and they have to go through the thorough vetting process that they should have to go through, it's a possibility that they may follow through on their word and that, Ted Craver may, uphold what he said he would, which is, we don't get restart, we're done. But again, these are all questions that, remain to be answered. So we'll see.
Well, it strikes me, actually, having watched this go on for a long time, that, occasionally nuclear utilities will threaten to shut a nuclear plant in a way of blackmail. But it seems to me that Ted Craver is looking for a number, looking for a price that would allow him to take these, blasted reactors out of their hair. Now, Arnie, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that this would be, if this ASLB process is followed, and as Kendra says, it goes for months and months and months, they'll miss a second summer, and no one is going to have any justification at all for restarting these reactors. Is that part of the scenario here?
Oh, yeah, and the price is huge. It cost them $800 million to put these steam generators in. It cost them another $500 million to do the repairs they've done so far and make up replacement power. And then in addition to that, they're paying the salaries of 2,000 people to work there. That's coming out of the rate base for another billion. So this fiasco has cost Californians more than $2 billion so far. And what do they have to show for it? Two power plants that don't run. I think if Californians realize that they're into this for $2 billion.
Well, this is quite an amazing scenario here, because if we do get these two reactors taken out and got to the point where they're permanently shut, which I think there's a pretty good chance it's going to happen if we keep the pressure up. We'll be down to 100 reactors in the U.S. Now, that's 100 way too many. In fact, it's a terrifying prospect. On the other hand, we started this year with 104. Two have shut, Winnekowani in Wisconsin and Crystal River in Florida.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? 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 Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went to...
All right, so that'll wrap it up here for another Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Thank you so much, Arne Gunderson, Kendra from the Friends of the Earth, Mike Keegan in Michigan, Mario Reason and Ace Hoffman in Southern California. We are talking here about the demise, hopefully soon, of the San Onofre Nuclear Power Reactors, Units 2 and 3 in Southern California. Next week, we'll be back with more about Vermont Yankee and other nuclear plants. Thank you so much for being with us on another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Do call in to NukeFree or tune in to NukeFree.org and find out what you can do to get us closer to Solartopia. We'll see you again next week.
Solartopia, Solartopia.